Muzu was six when an accident left her severely burnt. When Mercy Ships came to Sierra Leone, volunteer surgeons treated her scarring, and today Muzu is back at school. A gift of £20 could bring life-changing surgery for another child. Call 0800 995 6111 during business hours.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. I am delighted to welcome Dr. Holly Ordway to the show to speak about J.R.R. Tolkien. Holly is the Cardinal Francis George Professor of Faith and Culture at the Word on Fire Institute, as well as the Visiting Professor of Apologetics at Houston Christian University. She's written numerous books and articles about various members of the Inklings, but our focus today is Holly's newest book, which I've got right next to me, an absolutely fantastic spiritual biography of J.R.R. Tolkien called Tolkien's Faith, and I highly, highly recommend you get a copy of it. Holly, the first few years of Tolkien's life were pretty traumatic, weren't they?
They were very traumatic. So he was born in South Africa, actually, in Bloemfontein, South Africa. And when he was about 3 years old, his mother Mabel took him and his little brother Hilary back to England for what was supposed to be just, you know, a short stretch. While they were there, his father, Arthur, died quite unexpectedly. And so he's left, you know, no father. They never went back to South Africa. And so his mother, Mabel, is left to raise the boys by herself, which is in itself traumatic. They're living now in Birmingham. And then in 1900, when Tolkien was 8 years old, his mother became a Catholic. And this was a really big deal, very, very upsetting to the family because, you know, in these happily much more ecumenically minded times, people might not be thrilled that a family member became a Catholic. In fact, they might be quite upset, but they wouldn't react as strongly as was typical in the early 1900s when people could get, you know, disowned, have, you know, lawsuits to take their children from them. You know, it was a very difficult thing to become a Catholic, especially as a single mother, a widowed mother, becoming Catholic with her boys. Her family and her in-laws were very upset, and they cut off all of their financial support to her, which meant that the little family was then, you know, struggling with poverty. And Mabel toughed it out. She says, "No, I'm not going to go back on this." And that was something that Tolkien admired greatly. He saw that resolution in his mother and admired it. But it certainly made life difficult for them. And then it turns out that she had diabetes. And when Tolkien was just 12 years old, she died. Sadly, this is before the discovery of insulin. And, you know, she died when he was only 12 years old. And so he and his little brother became the guardians of a Catholic priest, Father Francis Morgan of the Birmingham Oratory. And this became a really, really essential part of Tolkien's upbringing because he becomes kind of the ward of an entire community. Which people often, if they know about Father Francis, they think, you know, well, here's the one Catholic priest. And Father Francis became what Tolkien later described as second father to him. But it wasn't just that one relationship. He had all these other sort of fathers and brothers in the community. It was a remarkable place for a young man to grow up. But here he was. He's 12 years old, and he's lost both his mother and his father. It's a terribly difficult time for a young man. And then, you know, he falls in love with Edith, who becomes eventually his wife, but there's drama over that. And we can go to that later if you want to. But, you know, Father Francis, for quite good reasons, forbids him to see Edith for several years until he comes of age. And remarkably, Tolkien obeys this out of love for his guardian. He could have found ways to disobey him. He could have kept in contact with Edith, and Father Francis would never have known. But he chose to obey it. Very difficult stretch for him, very painful, he said. But it also kind of tested and proved his love. They do eventually reunite. They get married. But then Tolkien goes off and has to fight in the First World War. And he fights in the trenches, where he contracts trench fever. He's 100% disabled and invalided out. And one of the things I discovered in my research for Tolkien's faith is that trench fever was a much bigger deal than we might realize. And if it hit you as a chronic disease, if you didn't get over it in a few weeks, it could actually damage your health permanently. And I think it did damage Tolkien's health permanently. So from, you know, age 4, when his father dies, to, you know, his 20s, when he finally is, you know, demobilized out of the war, sick with trench fever, there's a lot of trauma that's happened in there. It's a difficult stretch. And I think this really gives a depth and a texture to everything that Tolkien writes about. You know, when he talks about his character's suffering, yeah, he's been there. He knows about this.
Yeah. Well, as I say, we're going to talk specifically about his view on suffering, because obviously having experiential suffering means that he's able to write about it in such a beautiful and passionate way. But let's just go back to Mabel, his wonderful mother. Do we know why she began to investigate Catholicism, and how that journey from Anglicanism to Catholicism, how she sort of tracked along that journey?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and that's why I researched intensively for Tolkien's faith. We don't know a lot about it because we don't have many of her papers. Most of them were destroyed by one of the relatives, very inconsiderately. But we do know that she was herself, first of all, a convert to Anglicanism. She'd been raised in a Unitarian family. And I discovered in my research that she actually had an Anglican baptism as an adult in South Africa. So we know from the beginning that she was serious about her faith, and so was her husband, Arthur. They were serious. They were committed to their Anglican faith. Tolkien was baptized as an infant in the Church of England. So we have this sort of groundwork of a seriousness. So what was it that led Mabel towards Catholicism? Don't know for sure, but it seems to me that she was influenced by the Oxford movement. This movement of, you know, increasing interest in, you know, the Catholic heritage and more high church practices. The cathedral in Bloemfontein seems to have been fairly sort of Oxford movement-ish, or in, you know, fairly high church. And when she comes back to England, her biographer, Tolkien's biographer, Humphrey Carpenter, notes that she went looking for a high Anglican church. High is in, you know, Oxford movement type. Now, it turns out that at that time in Birmingham was where John Henry Newman had moved. He had been one of the great lights of the Oxford movement, had then gone on to become a Catholic, had gone to Rome, been ordained, and then come back to Birmingham and founded the Oratory, Congregation of the Oratory, St. Philip Neri. And it was actually at a church called St. Anne's, Alchester Street, that he had begun his ministry there. They had a ministry of reaching out to Anglicans to, you know, to answer their questions. And it was at St. Anne's, that very church, that Mabel first began her instruction as a Catholic. So kind of putting the pieces together, I would say that she's very interested in her faith. She's serious about it. She's interested in the Oxford movement's principles and going deeper into that. Probably came across John Henry Newman's writings. Oh, look, here we are in Birmingham with his mission continuing. There's outreach to Anglicans. She realizes that there's people who can answer her questions, and then finds that this is a very welcoming community. She ends up, when she becomes a Catholic, taking the boys to be part of the parish of the Birmingham Oratory, which again is really interesting and shows kind of her seriousness, her faith commitment. because at that time, the Oratory now is a beautiful, beautiful church. It wasn't then. It was a shabby, dingy little church with nothing impressive about it. She could have gone to the cathedral, St. Chad's Cathedral, but she didn't. She came to this shabby Oratorian church. Why? Well, it's the congregation founded by John Henry Newman. So again, a real sense of welcoming of converts. Almost all of the Oratory fathers were converts from Anglicanism. There's a real sympathy. There's no sense of us versus them. It's a sense of knowing where they came from, and a very positive, like positive attitude. And they're also very supportive of convert women. They had even a special ministry of helping, you know, widows and single mothers to be able to, you know, make a living, find work, be supported in their faith. And so I think Mabel made a very, very savvy choice. So, like, I want a place that's going to support me in my faith and support my boys. We're all converts here. We need the support. And so she makes a very prudent and, I think, wise choice in going to the Oratory.
Well, and you definitely touched on this in a previous episode, but would you just paint a bit of a picture of what it would like, what it would have been like to be a Catholic in the UK at that time?
Well, it would mean that compared to your friends and neighbors in your same sort of socioeconomic group, that you would be poorer than they were. You would be less socially acceptable than they were. You would have fewer economic and social opportunities wherever you were in the social scale. You would just go a notch down. And you would worship in a church that was newer and uglier and more cramped and unpleasant than you were used to. Because, you know, at the Reformation, you know, all of the existing parish churches were converted over to be Church of England churches, which left the Catholics with nowhere. I mean, of course, first, you know, for a long time, they were prohibited from gathering for worship, you know, doing it secretly, doing people's houses. You know, eventually it became legalized, but it wasn't even until the 1700s that Catholics were allowed to build any new churches at all. even there were restrictions, like you couldn't have steeples. They had to be, like, you couldn't call any attention to them. Finally, in the 1800s, Catholics are able to build churches again, but they don't have any money. And they're not given, you know, much leeway in terms of, you know, planning permission. So the churches are typically much cheaper built, you know, hastily constructed, plain, possibly shabby. And eventually you get these beautiful churches that are made, you know, and there's always exceptions in richer areas. But on the whole, Tolkien's experience in going from, you know, worshiping as a boy, you know, 7-8-year-old boy in Anglican churches, beautiful, ancient, you know, churches, very, now all of a sudden this crowded, shabby, you know, place. So it, and I think it underscores the sort of intentionality. You weren't a Catholic by accident in early 20th century England. You were a Catholic because you meant to be, because it was a whole lot easier to be an Anglican, to be honest.
Well, let's talk about the Birmingham Oratory, because obviously Tolkien and his brother Hilary came under the care of Father Francis, but as you say, also under the care of many of the other fathers in the Birmingham Oratory. How did that form his spirituality?
And it had a tremendous effect on him. And first, we have to know that this is during a really formative period of his life. From, you know, when he was about 10 was when his mother brought the boys to be there. By 12, he's sort of solely in the care of Father Francis, all the way up until he's 17, when he goes off to Oxford. So there's a 10-year stretch in which he is a really pivotal stretch in his formation as a young man, when he's being directly formed by the Oratory. And I find it very interesting to dive into, you know, what's the spirituality of the Oxford Oratory, I mean, of the Birmingham Oratory. And I looked, you know, really delved into who were the people he knew, who were the fathers then. Turns out lots of them were published authors. They were theologians, they were writing these books. So I looked at those books, you know, looked at what was being preached at the Oratory at that time. And so this is all an outworking of the spirituality of the founder of the Oratory, St. Philip Neri, who is a 16th century Italian saint, founder of the Oratory in Rome. And so this is the spirituality that their oratory is founded on. And there's a couple of really interesting aspects of this whole oratorian approach. One is that they really emphasize the intellectual life. They're really keen on books, art, music. So this is a really big deal at the oratory. And so he got a very early foundation in beauty, and he was amongst people who believed in the intellectual life. And I think this is an underrated influence, because he was a boy with, you know, kind of no prospects, no money. Father Francis paid a lot of their expenses out of his own pocket, because they had, you know, nothing. And he and the other oratorian fathers saw pretty quickly how remarkable John Ronald was. But even a remarkable boy, to get him into Oxford and pay for that schooling, you know, they could easily have said, hey, you're an orphan, you don't have any prospects, let's just apprentice you to a banker and make sure that you have a stable life ahead. They did not have to allow him to go to King Edward School. That was remarkable. They certainly did not have to allow him to go to Oxford and, you know, help pay for it. So that whole commitment to the intellectual life from the oratorians, underrated influence on why we know about Tolkien today. They also put a great emphasis on excellent preaching, particularly to the more educated in the community. So again, high level of standard for sermons, which meant, honestly, that Tolkien was pretty much disappointed the rest of his life at the quality of the sermons that he came across.
Peaked too early.
Yeah. But another interesting thing about the spirituality of the oratory is it puts a great emphasis on humility, on you need to use your gifts, but not puff yourself up. This is a really recurring important thread in oratorian spirituality. But paired with that is the importance of humor and playfulness, which is very distinctive of the oratorians. Philip Neri, the founder, was known for his jokes, his practical jokes on himself and on other people, all done with a serious purpose to kind of help you reflect, but a real playfulness. And that playfulness being used to kind of take yourself down a peg, you know, laugh at yourself so that you don't get puffed up. And so I think this is really formative for Tolkien, because if you look at his life, has so much tragedy in it, as we've already commented on. And yet, you know, you look at his personality as an adult, it's very understandable that he had a depressive streak, which he did. He had a streak, very strong melancholy. Hey, that's pretty obvious. But he also had this capacity for joy and playfulness that, considering what he went through, is not so obvious. But that was something that was fostered and encouraged by his community, his father's plural, you know, growing up. And then if you look at, you know, his late life, when he's a famous author, worldwide fame, it's astonishing how unserious he is about it, in a sense. You never get the impression of him going, oh, I'm the big author. He's always taking himself down a peg. He's often quite silly. And I remember, you know, years past, you know, reading some of the accounts of his jokes and his silliness, you know, when he gives his false teeth and part of his change when he's buying something at a shop. Things like that, are chasing his neighbor down the street, you know, dressed as an Anglo-Saxon warrior, you know, his playfulness. Like, this, in a way, almost seemed unfitting for this great author. But then I realized this really connects back to his upbringing and the emphasis on humility and humor. And you see that in some of his letters late in life, where he talks about the praise that's offered in letters. He talks about it as if it's incense. He calls it the incense, sweet smelling, like, you know, offered to idols. And, oh, it tickles the nose. Mm. But then he has to say, no, I don't really deserve this. I'm so little in comparison to that. And I think that real down-to-earth quality, that humility that kept him to be a genuinely, I think, humble man, even after the colossal success of his books, I think we can trace that all the way back to the oratory and that combination of humor and humility that he got, you know, in his formation.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
If you've ever struggled to fully understand the New Testament or explain your faith with confidence, you're not alone. That's exactly why Premier Insight exists and why your support matters right now. When you give today, we'll send you a special thank you gift, the New Testament You Never Knew Bible Study Guide by N.T. Wright. It will help you understand the context, meaning, and story of Scripture more clearly. And your support helps others do the same through programs like this. So please give your best gift today and request your copy. Just go to premierinsight.org/cslewis. Thank you for helping people engage God's word with wisdom and understanding.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Holly, I guess lots of people would perhaps know that Tolkien was a Christian, but how significant is it that he was Catholic specifically? Do we see his Catholicism coming out specifically in his writings at all?
I think so. I mean, it's interesting when you say, how do we see it coming out? Because he is very careful that everything he does is on the implicit level. He's not into allegory. No. He's not doing that. It's not overt. So everything that is infusing his books is fundamentally, it's at the fundamentals. It's deep down. So in that sense, it becomes quite difficult to parse out, you know, what bits are specifically Catholic as opposed to generally Christian. And it's not really necessary to parse out most of it. But I do think that we see a strong influence of his specifically Catholic Christian faith in the sort of incarnational quality of the stories. Because the idea that the body matters, that the word became flesh and dwelt among us. That's a really important part of sort of the Catholic view of the world. The idea of the sacraments, of grace, of God communicating his grace through material things, that faith is not just a question of having the right thoughts, but about living it out, you know, with your whole self. And I think that incarnational quality is something that we do see expressed in his stories and in all his writings. And that's something I would trace specifically to his Catholic faith.
Do we know how Tolkien viewed the Bible? And again, do we see influences of kind of biblical language permeating his work?
Well, he thought very, very highly of it, and could read the Bible in the original languages. I mean, he studied the New Testament in Greek as a boy at King Edward School. Interestingly, King Edward School is a Protestant day school. So the fact that he got permission to go there was, I think, an exceptional gesture from the Orator and Fathers that, again, being converts, they weren't afraid of Protestants. They were okay to let Tolkien go there knowing that he was grounded in Catholic teaching, you know, at home in the oratory. He knew Latin fluently, so he could read the Vulgate. And in his letters, there are lots of references, lots of scriptural references that he's making. He's very comfortable talking about the Bible. And in fact, late in life, he translated the Bible or translated a book of the Bible. So he translated the book of Jonah for the Jerusalem Bible and took great satisfaction in doing it and finished it on time, which, knowing Tolkien, is absolutely remarkable. So we have a sense of, you know, he takes scriptures very seriously. He read them devotionally. He read them devotionally in English. For instance, there's a copy of his New Testament that has pipe ash in the, in the margins, because he was clearly smoking his pipe whilst reading it very carefully. So this is really an important part of his devotional life, and he's very learned in it.
There's a wonderful quote in your book, Holly, from Simone Dardenne, if that is how you say her name, who talks about Tolkien belonging to that very rare class of linguists who were now becoming extinct, who could understand and recapture the glamour of the word. And she goes on to say that this love of the word led him to study languages wherever he could find them. So effectively, his kind of expertise in philology actually came from his love of the Bible. And I love that, because I think you often think of it the other way around, don't you? Oh, he was a philologist, so he loved the Bible. But actually, the idea that it all sort of started with his Catholic faith, I just think that's a really beautiful picture.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that passage, the prologue of the Gospel of John, is, objectively speaking, the passage of scripture that Tolkien heard most of any bit of scripture throughout his life, because all throughout his life, all the way to his very last couple of years of his life, the prologue of the Gospel of John is read at the end of every Mass. It's called the Last Gospel. So this, you know, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. That, more than any other passage, would have been sort of imprinted on him from his earliest time as a Catholic. He would hear it again and again and again in Latin, of course, but he knew Latin. And he studied Latin as a child. So he knew Latin very early on. So that, you know, I agree, a very fascinating connection, that he has this fascination with the Word, because, you know, the idea that the Word became flesh, we kind of take that for granted, but, like, you know, it didn't have to happen that way. You know, this connection between language and the incarnation, that's how God chose to do it. But it could have been otherwise, but that's how he chose to do it. So this fascination with the incarnate Word, and then therefore with words in general, language as a way of encountering reality, yeah, it's something that Tolkien tapped into really early on, and there's a connection that's, I think, a really profound connection.
Just before we get to the end of this podcast, Holly, would you say just a little bit, I know you touched on it, but the relationship between Tolkien and Edith, and the fact that actually it wasn't all plain sailing to start with, it had a bit of a rocky start, didn't it?
Yes. So, I mean, it's interesting because he, in one sense, had this amazing love story, but it was also very difficult. So he fell in love with Edith Bratt, you know, as a boy, as a teenager, and she was also an orphan. They were at the same lodging house, and she was a Protestant, but, you know, reasonably well disposed to Catholics. Her guardian was a Catholic, but she was a Protestant. They fell in love. So he had this teenage love. She's I think 4 years old when he was, and okay, that's lovely, but then it gets a bit rocky. Because Father Francis put a stop to it. Well, why did Father Francis put a stop to it? We this is a question worth asking, because it isn't just, oh, the fuddy-duddy priest interfering with young love. They had started, you know, sort of seeing each other in the sense of, you know, going out for walks and long conversations. This is budding into a romance. But Tolkien and Edith start doing things on the sly. They start lying about it. They say they're going to go one place separately, and then they meet up. And there was... It was all innocent. They just went for a walk. They just went for a bicycle ride. It's just, there's nothing going on here that was inappropriate. Not for Tolkien, with his deep religious convictions and the culture of the time, which is no. But they were lying about it. And that, I think, was the real red flag for Father Francis. Like, whoa. Lying is a sin. Like, this is what's going on here. And then, of course, he doesn't know anything about Edith. And Tolkien, being a Catholic, ought to have, you know, if he's serious about this young woman, she's not a Catholic, they need to have this conversation. Like, what's going on here? And the very fact this conversation has not been happening is also kind of problematic. So he tells them, like, okay, cool it. Don't see each other. They move to different lodgings. And then they do still end up seeing each other a couple of times, more or less by accident. But again, Father Francis is like, okay, this is not working out. You really need to not even write to each other until you come of age. So he separates them. And part of it, too, is that at this around this time, Tolkien is trying to get admission into Oxford University, and he needs to get a scholarship because there isn't enough money for him to go if he doesn't have a scholarship. And he sits his first scholarship exam and he fails. So one of the reasons that he failed it, you know, he was also just procrastinating with languages because that was a thing he did. But he partly, it was because he was distracted by his budding romance with Edith. It was occupying too much of his time and he wasn't paying attention. And I think Father Francis was just really concerned because he knew what gifts Tolkien had. He needs to go to Oxford. It's the only place that he's going to get the training he needs to fulfill his gifts. Again, he could have just said, fine, whatever, you know, go be a clerk somewhere. No, he wants him to fill his gifts. And he could have said, well, we'll send you off to another university. We'll send you off to, you know, to University of Dublin or whatnot. No, Oxford is the place he needs to go. He needs to get a scholarship. He needs to study. He needs to pass this exam the second time. Okay, no girlfriend. So I do think that even though it was tough love on Father Francis's part, but I do think that it was genuinely love, care for his ward. And Tolkien knew it and accepted that and abided by it. And then, you know, when they did reunite, it caused, there was definitely tensions between Tolkien's relationship with his second father, of course, but it is resolved. And Father Francis even made gestures like accompanying Edith on the train to Oxford so that she could see, you know, her fiance. You know, he made an effort, and that relationship eventually healed, and he became, after they're married, he became a grandfather figure to their children. But yeah, a very rocky start. But another kind of rocky bit of it was sort of Tolkien's own doing. Young men are zealous and, you know, in their own way. but it's interesting to note, you know, Tolkien was a Catholic. Edith was an Anglican. A lot of people have assumed that she had to become a Catholic to marry him. That is not the case. And I looked into this. I mean, talk about a nerdy rabbit trail. 1915 English canon law on marriage. Oh, my word. And I had to get some expert advice in this. It was very complicated and very nerdy. But the upshot was, especially in England, where Catholics are a minority, there were a lot of people who fell in love with someone who was not a Catholic. And it was perfectly possible for them to marry. And it would even have been, you know, blessed by the church. They couldn't have had a wedding in a mass, but they could have had recognized by the church. Edith would simply have had to agree not to interfere with the practice of Tolkien's faith. Their children would need to be brought up in the faith. And she would have been, I think, fine with that. So Edith didn't have to become a Catholic. And I think that's really important. And this was well known, and Tolkien would have been able to find this out easily from, there was a canon lawyer amongst the fathers that he was closest to. So why did she become a Catholic? She did it willingly. She did it willingly with a bit of arm twisting from Tolkien. And that's where some zeal here. Tolkien wanted her to become a Catholic, not just so that they could get married, but because he was very serious about his faith and he wanted his bride to join him. He wanted her to share what he had. And I think that is a really beautiful motivation. He was a little bit, I think, pushy. He wasn't willing to let Edith kind of do it on her own pace, which I think later in life he realized was not the best thing. And I think he didn't realize that by rushing her, she didn't get as good a preparation as he did. So she came into the church willingly, but not as well prepared as perhaps she could have been if she had been allowed to take her own time. And this ends up causing a lot of tensions later on, because Edith goes through a stage when they're in Leeds, they're after they're married, where she stops practicing her faith, her Catholic faith, for a while, and becomes quite hostile to Tolkien, for instance, bringing the children to Mass. And this causes a lot of tension in their marriage. It's very difficult, but they're committed to each other, they're committed to their marriage, they get through it, and eventually Tolkien, I think, has learned a little bit of wisdom at this point of like, don't do the arm twisting thing. It doesn't really help. And eventually she realizes that she can come back to the practice of her faith, and she does. And never, I think, as devoutly as her husband, but that was pretty high bar. So, you know, but she was, you know, living out her faith through the rest of her life. And she was given a Requiem Mass. They went to Mass together at the end of their life at Sacred Heart in Bournemouth, and that's where she had her Requiem Mass. So I think this is, I think, a good thing to know about, because one thing, I think, humanizes Tolkien. He didn't always do everything right. Hmm. And their marriage was beautiful, but it was beautiful in an authentic way. They loved each other. They were married for more than 50 years. They went through good times and bad times, and they had difficulties and disagreements that at times were really painful, but they were committed to each other and they got through it. They were faithful to each other. They're faithful to their marriage. And honestly, I think that is more beautiful than if they had just had this sort of fairy tale romance. It was all, you know, rainbows and roses the whole time. So it's real.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And do register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.